This is the Heartland Daily Podcast.
Everyone, and welcome to the podcast. It is the end of the year and a good time to start thinking about 2022. And from a political standpoint, midterm elections, you know, there's a lot of speculation that big changes could be taking place next year and whether this bodes well for finally fixing healthcare. Or should we just forget about Washington and put all our hope in the states? Many people would say we are witnessing two Americas, and maybe that is an opportunity. Probably not coincidentally, my guest today has launched a new think tank on healthcare. Brian Blaze is a well-known name in healthcare reform. He served on President Trump's team of economic advisors. He publishes a number of studies and op-eds, and he brings one of his public advisors in his new organization, Naomi Lopez of the Goldwater Institute. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you
very much.
Well, Brian, let's start with you. Tell us the name of this new organization, and am I correct? I mean, are you launching this given all the displeasure on what's been happening in the country? You know, we're big government and tyrannical vaccine orders, among a number of things that people have been complaining about.
Yeah, so the organization is Paragon Health Institute, and we just launched it last month, and it's a new public policy research organization solely focused on health reform, and we're focused on reforms at both the federal and state levels. And, you know, I've worked in health policy for more than a decade now, and it really is the most important area of public policy. I mean, if that wasn't clear before the pandemic, it certainly should be clear now. Government is heavily involved in the healthcare sector at both the federal and state levels. Much of what government does doesn't work out the way it's intended. And, you know, we wanted to launch this organization to provide market-oriented opportunities that put consumers and patients in control of their healthcare, that free providers to best meet patient needs, and that really focus on innovation and how innovation can in medical care, in the delivery of care, in pharmaceuticals, in medical devices, how that is really what's key to promoting health and improving our well-being over time.
Yeah, I'd like to ask both of you, let's say there is an upheaval next year, reformers do take over the House and Senate. Do you think it would be possible to get anything done that would be significant in healthcare that wouldn't be vetoed by the president, for example? Naomi, what are your thoughts on that? Oh, go ahead, Brian.
So as we know, there's a seemingly intractable stalemate when it comes to healthcare at the federal level. But what most people don't know is that states often lead in the way to healthcare reform. And let's give a recent example. That's a telehealth reform that just passed in Arizona that really is revolutionary in that it removes a lot of the government restrictions and obstacles that were standing in the way. State lawmakers have the authority and the responsibility to take action in some key areas when it comes to healthcare that impact healthcare access and affordability. And those would be things like scope of practice. What are the rules surrounding what healthcare providers can do? Can they practice at the top of their education and training? Areas like the practice of medicine, for example, telehealth. And so, regardless of what's happening in Washington, there is a lot that states can do to really impact patient access and affordability, and that often creates the groundswell for Washington to take action. And I do think that there are opportunities that where lawmakers can work across the aisle, because we demonstrate that constantly at the state level, where when it comes to healthcare access and affordability, there really are some great solutions that everyone can get on board with.
Brian, do you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. And I think in Washington, what you're seeing right now is a lot of overreach and really expansion of government, all this new spending, new taxes in healthcare. You know, they've got a lot of healthcare provisions in the Build Back Better Act. Many of them are harmful. Price controls on pharmaceuticals that would significantly reduce drug development and innovation. Lots of inefficient new spending and government controls. I think most experts, if you look at the prediction markets, think that Congress will probably switch back and then we'll have divided government in Washington after that. I think one of the benefits is that would stop a lot of the government overreach that we're seeing now. Clearly there is a need for federal reform, and part of what Paragon is doing is thinking through what those reforms could be that both are enacted through Congress and by an administration that is focused on the principles of consumer choice, market competition, and policies conducive to innovation. I think right now it makes sense to really focus at the states, given the opportunities at the state level to codify some of the actions that they took during COVID. That loosened government restrictions on telehealth, on scope of practice, but to move further too and go in other areas to expand consumer options, information that consumers and patients have to be the best possible shoppers of healthcare.
Paragon has already released a book. It's a compilation of a number of what I would call shovel-ready health reforms. Tell us the name of the book and why you wrote it.
So Naomi was very instrumental in sort of thinking through the book, and she is one of the authors of the chapter. And what we really wanted the message to states to be is that states have control, and they can take a variety of actions to improve health care for people in their states. So we titled it "Don't Wait for Washington: How States Can Reform Health Care Today." And it's very action-oriented. There's really three main themes within the book. The first is what states can do to be better managers of state programs. So there we're focused on the state employee health plan and the Medicaid program, which is the biggest health care program that states manage and has lots of waste, abuse, and improper spending. The second theme of the book is what states can do to allow providers to best meet patient needs. So that's, Naomi wrote one of those chapters on telehealth and what states can do to maximize patients' ability to benefit from telehealth and get, more affordable, accessible coverage. We also have chapters on freeing providers to best meet patient needs so that they're practicing at the top of their education. And then we've got an important chapter on certificate of need laws, which are these really anti-competitive policies that require providers, when they want to expand capacity and expand supply, to get approval from a government board that's often controlled by incumbent providers. They've been studied pretty extensively, and they fail on sort of every dimension on cost. They raise cost, they reduce access. The last focus of the book is what policymakers can do to expand options for consumers. So we have a chapter that focuses on what states can do to increase the types of coverage available to state residents. We have a chapter on what states can do to allow patients to really own and control their prescriptions. And then we have a chapter on what states should do to release information about providers so that patients can make the best decisions possible about where to receive care.
Naomi, you touched upon this a little bit earlier, but why, could you kind of dive in a little bit more about why you believe the states can really be the leaders on health reform?
So it's not just that I believe that the states can be the leader on health reform. The states often are the leader on health reform. And we know this from, the past couple of decades, where states have gone in and made policy changes that impact the scope of practice, or that really set forth an agenda that focuses on access and affordability at the state level. And as many people know, the Goldwater Institute was instrumental and led the effort for right to try at the state level before taking it to Washington. And now that is federal law. So we know how to make change at the state level. It is a bit slower, of course, because you're going state by state, but it's absolutely possible. There is, you know, the dynamics of the states are, you know, they're always a little bit different. But one thing that is you know, that states have in common is that state lawmakers really are a bit closer to their constituents. And, you know, they'll run into them more frequently at the grocery store or at church or at their kids' schools. And so there really is a little, you know, there's a closer association with the lawmaker. There's more access. And so I do think that that impacts how responsive state lawmakers are. And there also, there seems to be an easier ability to work across the aisle. Now, you know, obviously there are still political divisions at the state level, and some of those were not, you know, there really isn't a way to get around. But for some issues like telehealth, for example, there really was a consensus that those rules that, you know, that removing the barriers and obstacles, the rules and red tape that made telehealth difficult were removed during the pandemic, and it was good policy during the pandemic, and it should be made permanent. And so there really was a belief across party lines that that was good policy. And that's how Arizona was able to move this landmark telehealth legislation across the finish line. And so, you know, I think that a lot of times the media in Washington and a lot of times lawmakers in Washington aren't always as tuned in to what is happening at the state level, but there really is a lot of innovation taking place. And when you think back to things like welfare reform and you take a look at what's happening in healthcare today with really innovative solutions coming up, you know, the states really are the laboratories for reform. And I think that's something that we often forget, but that is truly where I think the best policy innovations take place and are tested. And then that makes it a lot easier to elevate it to the federal level.
Yeah, I know in my home state, there just seems to be more openness to finding common ground between both parties. And that's a very positive thing. You know, Brian, I know one of your signature topics is Medicaid reform. You've written a great deal on states being too lax on eligibility, but I know that's only part of what can be done. Can you expand on that a little bit more about what can be done in Medicaid? This is a huge program for all the states.
Sure. It's most states, when you combine the federal funds that states allocate, it's the largest budget item by far. It's the one that's growing the most rapidly. State resources are directed away from things like education, transportation, infrastructure, increasingly to Medicaid. You know, since we last spoke, the problem continues to get worse. Anne-Marie, a new CMS report came out that said just the federal share of improper payments in Medicaid is $100 billion a year. You know, if you include the improper payments at the state level, you're talking about total improper payments of about $150 billion a year, or wow, about 25% of program expenditures. So about $1 in $4 that's flowing out doesn't meet the rules of the program. A big challenge is around eligibility. And this started with the ACA expansion of the program. And it's about sort of state incentives not to properly check eligibility. But what we really recommend, and Jonathan Ingram of the Foundation for Government Accountability wrote this chapter for us in the book, is that states do some common sense things like verify people's the information that they put on their applications. So instead of accepting self-attestations and letting people enroll in the program, verify their information, their income information, their citizenship information, sort of household characteristics. And then there's also an issue of sort of hospitals can presumptively deem people eligible for Medicaid. It turns out that a lot of times hospitals do that. The people aren't actually eligible for the program. So the state is making expenditures on their behalf that are really unrecoverable. Some of this, I'd say the problem was worsened because of a provision of one of the initial coronavirus relief bills that prohibited states from doing eligibility reviews and removing ineligible applicants or ineligible recipients has a condition of receiving additional federal Medicaid funding. Mm-hmm. And states need to start doing redeterminations. And it really is, when you have so many people on the program that aren't eligible for it, you're taking away resources from the individuals that really do need Medicaid, right? There's basically a fixed amount of healthcare supply, and you're reallocating services away from those individuals who really need those services and that public support to people that don't need it as much. And you've seen problems with Medicaid expansion, like surge of emergency room utilization, increase in wait times for appointments, increase in ambulance response times. And actually, I mean, this is one of the things that I found from looking at the data. If you look at states that expanded Medicaid versus states that didn't expand Medicaid, the mortality trends were worse in expansion states during the first 3 years of the expansion than compared to non-expansion states. So there's just a host of problems. And this is really one of the things that comes down to good government, that states need to be better managers of Medicaid. I've also wrote my chapter in the book on what states can do to reform the state employee health plan. The state is the largest. The state government, in particularly if you include local governments, it's the largest employer in the state, and the state can take actions through its employee health plan to bring about reforms to get better value both for the recipients of the state employee plan, but also for the state's taxpayers.
Yeah,
and we've seen some states we've seen some states that have taken actions, and that's one of the things we really did in the book was highlight examples where states have taken productive, positive actions. Naomi mentioned Arizona's telehealth law, but we've got as many examples as we could to point states to of what other states have done that were positive reforms.
Yeah, well, that's a great idea, you know, in terms of reforming the individual market. Try it first in a group that you can control, like state employees, and figure out what works and what doesn't work. We're going to need to take a break. And when we come back, I want to ask you both about sweeping reform at the federal level. Could this be tried again after the Republicans lost it a couple of years ago on all three fronts when they had all their ducks in a row? So we'll be right back. You know, like so many donors, you might be using a donor advised fund for your giving because of the simplicity and the tax advantages it offers. But did you know that banks that manage charitable funds are increasingly hostile to conservatives? In fact, Fidelity Charitable and other national donor advised fund providers have refused to make grants to several conservative organizations like National Rifle Association, Turning Point USA, state think tanks, and others. The great thing about the market, though, is you do not have to stay with a fund that does not honor your values. Instead of leaving your charitable dollars with a commercial fund, you can move your giving to Donors Trust. Preserve your donor intent while maintaining the tax savings, the flexibility, and the privacy a charitable fund provides. Stop using a fund that creates barriers to investing in the causes and freedoms you care about. Roll over your donor advised fund to Donors Trust, the national donor advised fund that shares and honors your values. Donors Trust can help you roll over a pre-existing account in three simple steps. It can also help you get started with a new donor advised account. You can see how with your free donor prospectus. Go to donorstrust.org/heartland. That's donorstrust.org/heartland to see how to get started with a charitable partner that honors your values, Donors Trust. And we'll include a link in the podcast notes. All right. And we are back. So, back in 2017, when the Republicans control one party, control both chambers in Congress and the White House, we could not get sweeping health care reform passed. Now, maybe this will happen again. Who knows? But many hope with the Build Back Better reconciliation bill that is now in the Senate. That'll be another test. But if nothing happens with that, I mean, wouldn't that be an indication to say, all right, let's just forget Washington, nothing can get done? What are your thoughts on that?
I'm very optimistic about the future of healthcare reform. And I think, like Brian, we wouldn't be doing this work if we didn't believe that we could make impactful reforms that would truly, you know, allow us to realize the vision of healthcare access and affordability. Today, you know, and I think especially because of COVID, we actually do have a really unique opportunity, because a lot of the flexibilities that were enacted at both the federal and the state level that allowed for broader scope of practice, for example, for more telehealth and the like, and a lot of other reforms as well, really shed a bright light and provided a proof of concept that we really, there is an opportunity to do a lot more so that individuals can have access much faster than before. And I think that, you know, we're really getting to the point where Americans are really starting to understand that there's a potential to use innovative, patient-centric medical care using the already available technology and communications, that's already possible. We don't have to build something new. It already exists. And so often we also see federal overreach into the healthcare area, and I think that's becoming more apparent too. So I do think that with really strong, bold leadership coupled with very positive, successful reforms at the state level, we really will be able to realize a lot of the potential that already exists for realizing access and affordability in healthcare.
All right. Before I let both of you go, can you tell our listeners how they can follow your work and get your book?
Yeah. So please go to our website, paragoninstitute.org. And there are tabs for our initiatives. So we've got five initiatives at Paragon: Medicare reform, Medicaid and health safety net reform, private sector reform, public health and American well-being, and then state health reform. If you click on the state health reform tab, you'll go to our landing page for our book. So you can download the book there. We provide a lot of resources along with just the book. So we have short 3 to 4 minute videos that highlight each chapter that I conducted with the chapter author. And that provides sort of the basic overview of the problem that we're addressing, as well as what the recommendation is from the chapter author. But I just emphasize, we are really about action and positive results. So everything has policy recommendations, and we are we're here to provide the support, the education, to help state legislators and state policymakers advance a pro-patient, sort of pro-freedom health policy agenda moving into 2022 and beyond.
All right. And I should mention, we have a brief review in the next newspaper of healthcare news. So you want to tune in, take a look for that. Thank you, Brian and Naomi, for your thoughts and taking the time today to tell us about your new organization.
Hey, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Brian Blaze is the president of Paragon Health Institute, and Naomi Lopez is the director of healthcare policy for the Goldwater Institute. And if you enjoyed this discussion, become a regular subscriber to the Heartland Daily Podcast. That way you can get fresh, free market discussions on a wide variety of issues every time you load up your podcast app. And to help get the word out about these discussions, it helps to give us a thumbs up on your favorite podcast platform. Thank you for joining us. This is Anne-Marie Schieber.